The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
News Talk Summer Cash Machine.
The cash machine is full to the tippy top with another record-breaking amount. It's €307,000. That's the amount you need to know. Get your entry in by 3 o'clock on June the 19th. That's this coming Friday. The cash machine will then randomly pick a number, and it could be you were calling during Moncrief. Answer within five rings, tell us the prize amount, and the cash is yours. To enter, you can visit newstalk.com/cash machine, where you can enter online, or text the word play to 57557. The cost is €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Loud network of stations, and full terms are on our website, newstalk.com. Well, it's been another record-breaking night at the World Cup last night.
Messi. Gonzalez. Back to Messi. Messi! His first World Cup hat-trick, and it's a record setter.
That's the Argentina captain, Lionel Messi, becoming the oldest ever player to score a hat-trick at the World Cup. That also happened on the night where superstars Kylian Mbappe and Erling Haaland led their respective countries to victory. John Bruin of The Guardian joins me now. Hello, John.
Good morning, Claire. How are you?
I'm good. How are you surviving the hours of this World Cup, firstly?
Well, I don't think I am, to be honest. I watched the Haaland show, but I couldn't stay up for the Messi show last night. It's pushing it to stay up all night. If you've got a job as well, that's the difficult part, right?
That's the problem, isn't it? That is the problem. But just let's talk about Lionel Messi. I mean, I said that he was breaking records there, becoming the oldest ever player to score a hat-trick in the World Cup. But I was just reading some analysis of the performance and looking back on the videos this morning. He's just kind of tootling around the pitch. His only job is to get the ball in the back of the net if he can, if he's in the right place at the right time. And invariably, that ends up happening.
Yeah. I mean, spectacular strikes, weren't they? Just incredible. For a man of his advancing years, he has managed to pare down football to a series of, scoring spectacular goals. Though I should say, it should be mentioned, he probably should have been sent off before this.
That's right.
Are we to start twitching the conspiracies about this? I don't know if you saw the footage of when Messi's going for his hat trick and has a shot saved. We cut to Gianni Infantino with a big smile on his face because Messi scoring a hat trick. Well, that washes away quite a bit of the controversy, doesn't it?
Well, it's like we were saying before the World Cup. You know, all of the controversies around it. Then once the football starts, everybody starts talking about the football. And if Messi scores a hat trick, that dominates the headlines today and probably tomorrow. So you can see where we're going with this.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, Messi scores a hat-trick and stories of the treatment of the Iran team having to fly out of the US on the day of the game, that drops down the sidebar of shame or whatever, doesn't it? And therefore, we talk about Messi, we talk about record-breaking, we talk about World Cup legacy and stuff like that. This is it. Football, the brilliance of some of the football played at World Cups and the brilliance of the World Cup... it was put to me that the sport washes itself, doesn't it? It washes away quite a lot of ills, but ills that we shouldn't forget. I think it would be irresponsible to do that.
And did you think that Messi should have been sent off?
Yes, I do. Yeah, if that was an Algerian, he'd have been sent off for it, you know. And that's it. You can't do that. And in an era of VAR. That's a red card. Messi knew he'd done it as well. I don't know if he did it deliberately, but he knew that he'd committed the offence. It was nasty. But, you know, he's a crotchety old man, isn't he? That's the thing. But he's also a brilliant footballer as well.
What is he, 38?
I think he's 39 during the tournament.
Okay.
So,
he mentioned incredible. Something, didn't he, John, about personal problems at the end of the match, and thanks to everybody for helping me get through it. We don't know what he's talking about, though. He didn't elaborate.
No, and this is the thing with Messi, is he's unknowable, isn't he? That's the thing. He keeps himself. He's a superstar who no one really knows. That's it. There is this, there are occasional flashes of personality. I don't know if you recall back in the 22 World Cup, there was him speaking to, being quite abusive actually towards the Dutch players, in a side of him that we've never really seen. Obviously there is this deep competitive edge, there must be, if he's continuing on like this, but we're not sure. And it probably won't come out, or you know, the back channels will reveal it perhaps, but that's just Messi. We don't know him. He's different to Ronaldo, isn't he? Ronaldo almost presents this sort of Stepford Wives version of himself, doesn't yes. he, with all the social media stuff. Messi is on lots of adverts, but even in adverts, he sort of is unknowable there too, isn't he? He's mm-hmm. just a unspeaking guy, Only David Beckham is more present, from what I understand, of all the advertising out there. Beckham is advertising everything. Chainsaws, I think I saw at one
really?
Point. But yeah,
That in itself is extraordinary. And there's a whole story to talk about there, which we won't go into now, with him and his family and all the rest of it. But I want to talk to you about Iraq and Norway. I mean, Norway haven't been in the World Cup for 28 years, Iraq for four decades. I heard a gorgeous interview on the BBC World Service this morning with this American Iraqi fan who travelled 6 hours on a plane with his family to get to that game. And he said it was such a joy to have people talk about our footballers and not our problems that we've experienced in our country for decades. And just the pure joy that they had from that experience. And this interview had taken place after the match, when they were defeated 4-1 by Norway, but such a joy for them to be there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 1986 was the last time they were in the World Cup. And the Iraqi team actually has been quite decent. I remember them winning the Asian Cup at a time when the country was at its worst during the conflict, back to mid-2000s. So there's a lot of footballing legacy there, but the same for Iran as well, in that region. They're very strong teams, but it feels like this is, again, we go to the sort of soothing balm of the World Cup, don't we? That nationhood can be expressed in a slightly different way by football. It's not military. It's a national pride that a team can bring, to people from the diaspora of a country can go and watch their team play and enjoy them. And even when they lose, just to be at a World Cup feels so precious. I mean, I remember the first World Cup game I ever went to was Saudi Arabia Tunisia, which doesn't sound the most glamorous fixture, does it? But I gained an understanding of how much it meant to the people that were there from Saudi and from Tunisia, that were just, you know, to be at a World Cup, to be at the whole world looking at your team, it means so much. And again, it does. This is what wipes away some of the stuff that Gianni and Trump and yes. all these people. It's that's the sweet spot that they can feed off, and that's the sort of unforgivable bit about the cynicism that goes on with a World Cup, isn't it?
So France beat Senegal last night, and I see people are saying now that we have seen in the second half of that match the team to beat, that France have arrived. Do you agree?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, Mbappe seems to turn it on at a World Cup, doesn't he? But they've got Mbappe, they've got Dembele, they've got this Michael Olise, who we in England regret. He's from South London. We regret that he chose to play for France, because he is such a fantastic player, and he was a real talent at Crystal Palace. But since he's gone to Bayern Munich, we've seen what a brilliant player he is. That's it, isn't it? In a World Cup, they were not great against Senegal in the first half. Senegal were very good. They're a very talented team. And then they can just turn on the afterburners and be brilliant. And Mbappe can be that guy. That perhaps he isn't for Real Madrid. He scores a lot of goals for Real Madrid, but his image has been tarnished a little bit. And the things with Mbappe is, beyond, below the Ronaldo, Messi, I mean, these two guys are still knocking around. He's probably the world's best or most famous player, but he's never quite got to their level. That's the thing, and that's it. That Messi and Ronaldo did set, and Messi in particular, actually, set such impossible standards for those to follow.
And listen, we have the big one tonight, England-Croatia, 9 o'clock. How are you feeling ahead of it, John?
Well, a certain amount of trepidation, of course. And you know, with it, the whole thing about a World Cup is most people experience it at home, don't they? And this is it. We've had to wait a long time. It feels like the World Cup's been going on for weeks and there's been no England. My sympathies go to my colleagues that have had to cover essentially nothing for weeks while England don't play and everyone does. And so we enter the tournament. We're up against a Croatian team who are very familiar opponents. So familiar. I mean, some of these, they've got a 40-year-old. They've got, I think some of the players have played like 130 games together and stuff like that. It's incredible. But expectation in this country is high. But I don't think there's quite, we've quite got the John Bull thing of a few years ago of just, we're going to win this, we have to win this.
Doesn't seem to be there. And this will be an interesting match because England, they've won 6 times out of 11 meeting Croatia, but Croatia's taken 3 and drawn 2. So we will wait and see what happens. John, we have to leave it there, but good to talk to you and I'm sure we'll chat again over the course of the World Cup. That's John Bruin there from The Guardian. Now we move to a story that you'll see in your headlines today, HICWA releasing this new report, which says that Irish guidelines on what constitutes low risk alcohol consumption may need to be reconsidered. And I'm joined by Dr. Paddy Barrett, who's a preventative cardiologist at Blackrock Clinic, to talk about alcohol. Paddy, you're very welcome.
Good to see you.
We had planned a conversation around alcohol and then HICWA this morning made these comments about the guidelines. What are they saying? I know you've had a look. What are they saying?
Yeah, so I think these guidelines in general don't really say anything different than we've already known based on the data that we've seen over decades and decades. But as we've evolved our database on alcohol, it has become more refined that there is no amount of alcohol that is good for you. And that every increase in alcohol consumption comes with an increase in risk. And this is a change from historical data, where historically we used to think that 1 to 2 drinks kind of maybe on a daily basis had some form of protective effect. But more recent literature has shown that that is actually not the case.
And we have seen, haven't we, in the guidelines that there is a different safe level right now in the official guidelines when it comes to men and women. And HICWA now saying, actually, you know what? That's not probably right and it needs to be relooked at.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the thing to always, I think, frame this conversation is that discussions around alcohol in Ireland can be a touchy conversation. And we always have to look at this through the lens of data and how high quality that data is. And we can make statements around health claims, for example, but we can't make claims around what it is to have a drink with a friend or a parent on Christmas Eve or things like that. But it's very clear that there's a straight line in terms of the amount of alcohol that you consume and the amount of risk that is accrued when it comes to health-related illnesses. That's all-cause mortality, that's the chances of dying from anything, heart disease, cancers, dementias, etc., road traffic accidents, suicides, fatal burns, take your pick. But the greatest amount of the risk accrues with the highest amount of the consumption. And if you look across a lot of developed societies, you'll find that about maybe 20 to 30% of people who drink alcohol consume 50% of the alcohol. So this is the thing that is really, really applicable to them. But for someone who's drinking, you know, a handful of drinks per week, the incremental risk is likely to be very modest.
We don't like talking about this in Ireland. I mean, you just referred to it there, that it's something that can be uncomfortable to have this conversation. We like to stick our fingers in our ears and not hear the evidence. Do you agree?
I would think so. And there's obviously a lot of cultural context for this. So I always preface this conversation by saying that I'm someone who drinks alcohol. I drink very, very little and an awful lot less than I used to.
What is very little?
So I would drink, on an average, any given week, I might drink nothing for weeks on end. And then I might have a couple of, maybe a handful of drinks over a week in terms of...
On a holiday or Christmas
or
whatever.
Yeah, things like that. So it wouldn't be unusual. So I have no problem sitting down, having a drink. And there's no problem kind of with that. But I would drink very, very little by, I suppose, contemporary standards. But what I would also say is that alcohol consumption in general, globally and in Ireland, has decreased considerably. So although there is somewhat of a prickly nature around the discussion around alcohol, alcohol consumption has decreased considerably.
So when you're having your occasional, whatever it is, drink, do you say to yourself, there is a risk associated with me having this one drink?
No, Because there's a risk associated with everything. There was a risk associated with you coming into work today in terms of a risk of a fatal road traffic accident. There's a risk in everything that we everything we do. So we have to trade off those risks against one another. And we also have to say, well, how big or real is that risk? And for very small amounts of alcohol consumption, the literature would say that the risk increase is very, very small, or in small randomized studies that we have on this, the risk increase is not there in terms of, say, high blood pressure or certain diseases. So I don't think for one second that the risk increase that is accrued by having a small amount of alcohol on a regular basis is not a meaningful increase in risk that I believe is not traded off with the enjoyment and satisfaction that comes with my life in terms of the experience of having that drink.
I just think we don't get it. Like, 'cause I think that we look at having a drink on a Thursday night, a Friday night and a Saturday night, and that drink could be half to a bottle of wine, say, that we think that's okay because I'm not drinking every night of the week. And that's just not true. It's not safe.
Well, I think based on the data, that is correct. But we also have to be very clear about the fact that you can have a very maladaptive relationship with alcohol and you might only drink once a month.
Binge.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily the binge drinking, so the total number of units. It's all the secondary consequences that come with that. The impact on family, on work, on relationships, on basically goals that you had made. And so we all know that one particular person who kind of drinks very infrequently and it is carnage. So it's not about the amount of drinks. It's about the relationship that you have with alcohol. For me personally, one of the things that actually pulled back my alcohol consumption considerably was not a concern around health risks. It was actually how it impacted my sleep. So we have very clear data that it actually impacts sleep very poorly in terms of the amount of REM sleep that you will get overnight. You're much more likely to have light sleep overnight rather than deep restorative sleep. That is why after drinking a considerable amount of alcohol, you're likely to wake up in the middle of the night because you're in light sleep. You're likely to feel more tired in the morning despite having had the same number of hours of sleep because it's not the same depth of sleep that you're getting. Mm-hmm. So for me, the impact from a sleep perspective was huge. And also I get horrendous hangovers. So the price that I was paying was too high.
And you've got young children, so
yeah.
Just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Did you see that controversy with Steve Bartlett, the Diary of a CEO presenter? I had three drinks, it ruined my life for 3 days. And there was a massive online pile-on on him afterwards. But I suppose it depends on what your personal tolerance is, right?
So what I would say is I'm not a huge fan of Steve Bartlett, but what I would say is I think the pylon was basically people trying to capitalize on his notoriety and fame. But what I will say is that I think if you actually look at what he said, he basically said that the next day, I think, was a problem. And then that had knock-on effects from a practical point of view in terms of the things that he did. So in terms of kind of causing problems for 3 days of your life, That's legitimately true, because everyone can point to kind of like, yes, I went out kind of late last night and maybe I drank too much. And then the fallout the next day caused subsequent practical problems for the next 2 to 3 days. So it's not that he was dying from some hangover for 3 days.
Yeah, but you could also be really busy at work and get not enough sleep, and that can have a knock-on effect on a few days.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so these are all kind of, it's all about performance and about how you feel kind of in the world. So the thing that I would really try and kind of state is there's no amount of alcohol that is healthy. That's one of the things that has fundamentally changed.
So when we hear, oh, a glass of red wine, it's good for this, that and the other.
Yeah.
No,
this is one of the things that cardiologists were really kind of at fault for, talking about the idea that red wine is good for your heart and this nonsense about the ingestion of resveratrol that was in the skin of basically red grapes. Now, if you look at the resveratrol data and you actually equate that to the number of kind of units of alcohol or wine that you'd have to consume, you would have to consume hundreds, if not thousands, of units of alcohol of red wine per day.
Barrels of it.
Yes, to get the amount of resveratrol. So if you're thinking that that's your strategy to actually improve your heart health, you're sadly mistaken. But this is where we think we need to be very, very clear about this. But occasional alcohol intake is not an issue. The problem is how people put a calibration or line around what their alcohol consumption is. And I think using units of alcohol is imprecise, and often the best way to do it is really to reflect on it yourself, to say, listen, do I think that I'm consuming a little bit too much alcohol? Mm-hmm. Because that integrates everything in terms of kind of like, yeah, you really know how it affects your sleep, your relationship, your work, and all the different performance metrics, whether you're going to exercise, whether you will eat poorly kind of the next day. And all of those have been kind of clearly defined. And it's very hard to pin that down in a study, but you on self-reflection can identify that very quickly.
But what you're not saying to me is, if you're going out to meet your friends or meet your family, like, in that circumstance, occasionally, go out and have your drinks, it's fine. You're not saying not to do that.
Well, I don't think personally for me, and I can only speak for myself personally, I don't think the evidence is there that occasional alcohol intake increases my risk of chronic diseases to a degree that I find concerning, in the context that I do an awful lot of things to actually decrease that risk across other domains as well.
So if a person has a generally unhealthy life and then they're going out and having the couple of drinks occasionally, then they're in a riskier position than you would be.
Correct. You're just but you're adding to the pile of risk factors. So if you drink occasionally, but also happen to smoke and kind of are significantly overweight, have diabetes, high blood pressure, kind of high cholesterol, kind of don't do any activity, it's not going to help in any way, shape or form. And if anything, it's going to actually make things worse. One of the other things that you find is that alcohol consumption, even a small amount of alcohol consumption, means that people are more likely to make decisions that are, say, poor for kind of nutritional point of view. They're more likely to be disinhibited. Yeah, it's all the downstream consequences that come the next day. And then you have, you know, the next day in terms of like, I'm not going to go to the gym. I'm not going to exercise. I'm going to eat all this kind of rubbish and crap. And, you know, that's with kind of modest amounts of alcohol consumption. So it's not necessarily just the alcohol in that sense that actually causes the problem.
Dr. Paddy Barrett bringing all the good news. Thank you so much for being with us.
The Claire Byrne Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.